Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I really don't know how to describe it, being the fact that I talked to him on Friday, but seeing him go in there and just shoot innocent people was ridiculous. It was a horrifying scene. I've never heard gunshots like that loud, so it was very, very scary.
In what's being called a domestic act of terrorism, a white supremacist armed with an assault rifle opened fire in a supermarket in a black neighborhood Saturday in Buffalo, killing 10 people. Of the 13 shot, 11 were black. We'll go to Buffalo, New York, to speak with India Walton, former Buffalo mayoral candidate, longtime community activist. And we'll talk to Professor Ibram X. Kendi, whose new piece for The Atlantic is headlined "The Danger More Republicans Should Be Talking About: White Supremacist Ideology Is Harmful to All, Especially the Naive and Defenseless Minds of Youth." We'll also look at how the Buffalo Shooters Manifesto refers to the Great Replacement, a racist conspiracy theory promoted by far-right media figures like Tucker Carlson on Fox News.
It seems like just the other day that America's self-described moral leaders were denouncing us for pointing out the obvious. Democrats are intentionally accelerating demographic change in this country for political advantage.
Then massive abortion rights protests took place across the United States Saturday, kickstarting what reproductive justice advocates are calling a summer of rage.
Today is day one of an uprising to protect abortion rights. It is day one of our feminist future, and it is day one of a summer of rage where we will be ungovernable. Ungovernable.
We'll speak with Renee Bracey Sherman, founder of We Testify, her new Time magazine piece, "Voting Won't Save Abortion Rights." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Residents of Buffalo, New York, gathered at vigils Sunday to mourn the 10 people killed a day earlier when a white supremacist wearing body armor and carrying an assault rifle opened fire on a supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood. Of the 13 shoppers and store workers shot in the assault, 11 were black. Among those killed was 72-year-old Kat Massey, who wrote to the Buffalo News last year in support of federal gun control laws. Police arrested an 18-year-old suspect who reportedly live-streamed the massacre on the video streaming service Twitch. The site took the video down within minutes, but the footage continues to circulate among white supremacists online. The suspect left behind a racist manifesto that included a plan to target a mainly black neighborhood. The manifesto plagiarized heavily from a screed left behind by the white supremacists who killed 51 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2019. The manifesto refers to the Great Replacement, a racist conspiracy theory promoted by far-right media figures, including Tucker Carlson of Fox News, and embraced by some Republicans, including New York Congressmember Lee Stefanik. Prosecutors say the shooter purchased the Bushmaster XM-15 semi-automatic rifle used in the assault lawfully from a licensed gun dealer in his hometown of Conklin, New York, after he passed a background check. That's despite the fact that the suspect previously threatened a mass shooting at his high school the year before. He allegedly modified his rifle to use high-capacity magazines that are banned in New York State. President Biden spoke from the White House Sunday as the nation mourned the attack.
We're still gathering the facts, but already the Justice Department has stated publicly that it's investigating the matter as a hate crime. Racially motivated act of white supremacy and violent extremism. As they do, we must all work together to address the hate that remains a stain on the soul of America. The hearts are heavy once again, but a resolve must never ever waver.
The White House says President Biden will visit Buffalo Tuesday to meet with families of the victims. We'll have the latest on Saturday's mass shooting in Buffalo after headlines. Saturday's massacre in Buffalo came on another bloody weekend of gun violence across the United States. In Southern California, one person was killed and four others critically wounded Sunday after a gunman opened fire at a Presbyterian church in Orange County. Most of the victims were of Taiwanese descent, though it's not clear whether race played a role in the shooting. Local officials said the shooting could have been even worse.
From what we know, there was a shooter that came in with multiple weapons and started opening fire. And fortunately, some of the parishioners here in the congregation jumped on the shooter and tackled him, brought him down to the ground, and held him until the sheriff's department came and was able to arrest the individual.
Meanwhile, in Chicago, at least five people were killed and 27 others wounded in shootings across the city since Friday. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been nearly 58,000 gun deaths across the U.S. since President Joe Biden's inauguration. Abortion rights protests took place across the United States Saturday, kickstarting what organizers are calling a summer of rage. Organizers said 20,000 people rallied in Washington, D.C., with over 10,000 more in New York. Protests took place in over 400 cities and towns as part of a coordinated day of action dubbed Bans Off Our Bodies. The protests came after the publication of a leaked draft opinion showed the Supreme Court is preparing to overturn Roe v. Wade. Speakers in Washington included Rachel O'Leary Carmona, the executive director of the Women's March.
Today is day one of an uprising to protect abortion rights. It is day one of our feminist future. And it is day one of a summer of rage where we will be ungovernable. Ungovernable.
Monica Simpson, the executive director of Sister Song, also spoke in Washington, D.C.
We need you to get in this fight with us. We need you in every action. We need you in every state, in every place, and everywhere to ensure that we have the reproductive justice that we deserve. I know it's a hard fight, y'all. I know we got the long haul to go, but if we stay connected, if we stay together, then I believe that we will win. Do y'all believe that we will win? I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will. That's what I'm talking about. Peace and blessings, everybody. Thank you.
We'll have more on the Bans Off Our Bodies protests later in the show. Leaders of Sweden and Finland have formally announced they'll seek to join NATO within days, ending decades of neutrality. If accepted, Sweden and Finland would become the 31st and 32nd nations in NATO. Finland shares an 830-mile border with Russia, which has warned both countries it would be a grave mistake to join NATO. On Saturday, Russia cut off electricity to Finland. Russia had provided Finland with about 10% of its electricity. Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson spoke on Sunday.
Today, the Social Democratic Party has concluded that Sweden should join NATO. Our 200-year-long standing policy of military non-alignment has served Sweden well. But the issue at hand is whether military non-alignment will keep serving as well. And Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine is not only illegal and indefensible, it also undermines the European security order that Sweden builds its security on.
Turkey, which is a member of NATO, has voiced concern over Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance, but it's not expected to veto their membership. Turkey's long accused Sweden of supporting the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is banned in Turkey. In news from Ukraine, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell made a secret trip with other Republican lawmakers to meet Ukraine's President Zelensky in Kyiv on Saturday. The trip comes as the Senate's preparing to vote as soon as Wednesday on a $40 billion military and economic aid package for Ukraine. Arms control experts are expressing concern the massive military package could lead to a surge in arms smuggling because the U.S. has few systems in place to track the arms pouring into Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has accused Western nations of waging what he called a hybrid war against Russia.
The collective West has declared total hybrid war on us, and it is hard to predict how long this will last, but it is clear the consequences will be felt for everyone, without exception. We did everything to avoid a direct clash, but now that the challenge has been thrown down, we of course accept it. We are no strangers to sanctions. They were almost always there in one form or the other.
Foreign ministers of the G7 are warning Russia's invasion of Ukraine is leading to a global hunger crisis. This is Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock.
Russia has deliberately decided to extend the military war against Ukraine into a war of grains, a so-called wheat war, into many states across the world, especially Africa. With the blockade of Ukrainian grain exports as a result of destroyed transport routes and warehouses, the Russian incursion into Ukrainian territory in the east and in the south of the country, we are now faced with this incredibly difficult problem. Russia's actions are causing supplies to fail, prices to rise immeasurably, not only in our country, but around the world, and the threat of brutal hunger.
In related news, India has imposed a ban on wheat exports, citing a risk to the nation's food security caused in part by the war in Ukraine, as well as a massive heat wave. Russia's extended the pretrial detention of WNBA superstar Brittany Griner by another month. The two-time Olympic gold medalist and seven-time basketball WNBA All-Star has been jailed in Russia since February after cannabis oil was allegedly found in her luggage when she flew into Russia to play during the WNBA's off-season. The U.S. State Department recently declared Griner is being wrongfully detained in Russia. The Saudi oil giant Aramco has reported making nearly $40 billion in profits during the first 3 months of the year. That's an 80% jump over last year. The Wall Street Journal reports Aramco recently became the world's most valuable company, surpassing Apple. The company is now worth $2.4 trillion. Palestinians held protests across the occupied West Bank and Gaza on Sunday to mark the 74th anniversary of the Nakba, or catastrophe, as they call it, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes after the State of Israel was formed. At least 16 Palestinians were injured in the West Bank city of Al-Bireh when Israeli forces attacked a Nakba Day protest. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said seven Palestinians were shot by live ammunition, three others by rubber-coated steel bullets. Meanwhile, Israel is facing international condemnation after Israeli forces attacked mourners on Friday at the funeral of the Palestinian-American Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot dead while covering an Israeli raid in the Jenin refugee camp. A spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was, quote, deeply disturbed by what happened at the funeral. In Lebanon, voters headed to the polls on Sunday for the first parliamentary election since 2018. Lebanon is facing a dire economic crisis with the official unemployment rate at 30%. In news from Somalia, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud has been sworn in as Somalia's next president after beating 35 other candidates in a long overdue election. Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud previously led Somalia from 2012 and 2017. Somalia is facing multiple crises, including a devastating devastating drought and an arms insurgency led by the group Al-Shabaab. Earlier this month, the fighters attacked an African Union base in Somalia, killing 10 soldiers from Burundi who were serving as part of an African Union peacekeeping team. And in political news, today is the final full day of campaigning ahead of Tuesday's closely watched primary races in Pennsylvania. On Friday, Pennsylvania's Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who's running for the U.S. Senate, suffered a stroke but said he's on his way to full recovery. Meanwhile, in the Republican Senate race, polls show a tight three-way race between television doctor Mehmet Oz, who was endorsed by Donald Trump, hedge fund executive David McCormick, and far-right Republican Kathy Barnett, who has soared in the polls in recent weeks. Over the weekend, Barnett and Republican gubernatorial candidate Doug Mastriano banned reporters from campaign events. Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Will Bunch described the ban as part of a, quote, dramatic escalation in the war on a free press in America, unquote. In other political news, Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland suffered what he called a minor stroke on Sunday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Residents of Buffalo, New York, gathered at vigils Sunday to mourn the 10 people killed on Saturday when a white supremacist wearing body armor and carrying an assault rifle opened fire on a supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood. Of the 13 shoppers and store workers shot in the assault, 11 were black. Buffalo resident Grady Lewis witnessed the shooting.
I was standing right across the street, and I heard a shot that I knew wasn't a firecracker. And I looked up, and all I seen is smoke, and a guy just shooting across in the parking lot. And then I seen the security guy run inside the store. And when he ran inside the store, the other guy bent down and was just shooting inside the store. And I heard like at least 20 shots inside the store. And I didn't have a phone on me, so I was just yelling and screaming for people to call the police. And I looked over, I seen a woman on the ground. I seen a man on the ground. I seen another woman on the ground behind the gate.
Police are calling the massacre a domestic terror attack. They've arrested an 18-year-old suspect who reportedly live-streamed the massacre on the video streaming service Twitch. The site took the video down within minutes, but the footage continues to circulate among white supremacists online. The suspect left behind a racist manifesto that included a plan to target a mainly black neighborhood. Investigators say he'd researched the area and drove about 200 miles from his home in Conklin, New York, before arriving a day in advance to conduct reconnaissance. The manifesto heavily plagiarized a screed left behind by the white supremacists who killed 51 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2019. The manifesto refers to the Great Replacement, a racist conspiracy theory promoted by far-right media figures like Tucker Carlson of Fox News and embraced by some Republicans, including New York Congressmember Elise Stefanik. Prosecutors say the shooter purchased the Bushmaster XM-15 semi-automatic rifle used in the assault lawfully from a licensed gun dealer in his hometown after he passed a background check. That's despite the fact that the suspect previously threatened a mass shooting at his high school the year before. He allegedly modified the rifle to use high-capacity magazines that are banned in New York State. President Biden spoke from the White House Sunday as Buffalo mourned the attack.
We're still gathering the facts. Well, already, the Justice Department has stated publicly that it's investigating the matter as a hate crime, racially motivated act of white supremacy and violent extremism. As they do, we must all work together to address the hate that remains a stain on the soul of America. The hearts are heavy once again, but a resolve must never, ever waver.
The White House says President Biden will visit Buffalo Tuesday to meet with victims' families. Journalist Madison Carter's tweet eulogizing one of the victims, Pearlie Young, went viral. Carter wrote, quote, "Pearlie Young, 77, was killed today in Buffalo shopping for groceries. For 25 years, she ran a pantry where every Saturday she fed people in Central Park. Every Saturday. She loved singing, dancing, and being with family. She was a mother, a grandma, and missionary. Gone too soon." The other named victims are former Buffalo Police Lieutenant Aaron Salter, who is an off-duty guard. Also killed were Ruth Whitfield, Catherine Cat Massey, Hayward Patterson, Celestine Cheney, Roberta Drury, Geraldine Talley, Andre McNeil, and Margus Morrison. We go now to Buffalo, New York, where we're joined by India Walton, former Buffalo mayoral candidate, longtime community activist, now a senior advisor for senior projects for Working Families Party and a senior strategic organizer with Roots Action. India, welcome back to Democracy Now! Right now, you're just a few blocks from the grocery store where the shooting took place. Can you describe your response over the weekend and what's happening in your community?
There are a lot of heavy hearts in Buffalo right now. Details are still emerging, Amy. And as a matter of fact, I didn't know that Cat Massey was one of the victims. I started my organizing career right here in the Fruit Belt, and Cat was a pillar of this community and a longtime supporter of mine in the work that I did, a woman who wrote a $10 check every month to support our community land trust. And these are some of the folks that we lost in this very horrific and tragic incident.
First of all, my condolences on this horror that has befallen your community, this act of domestic terrorism that has taken so many, including the mother. The oldest victim is the mother, right, of the retired fire commissioner.
Yes. You know, there is a broader conversation that has to be had, right? The former fire commissioner's mother was in that grocery store because it is the only place for Black folks to shop on this side of town, right? So this is not only a question of a lone actor who was a white supremacist. It is a conversation that has to be had and policy that has to be made to undo the systemic harms that have been caused by a structure of white supremacy that has not only permeated the United States of America, but it also has trickled down into cities just like Buffalo. Like, you know, we know that 80% of the population of the east side of Buffalo are people of color, are Black people specifically, and they have one place to shop. And now they have zero places to shop because we don't know when our grocery store is going to open back up on the east side.
I mean, this is a critical point, this Tops grocery store. I mean, before it was brought into the community, it's in other parts of Buffalo, but it wasn't here. You had a food desert here. And right now, because it's closed, you have people who are desperately trying to get what the services that this store provided, like prescription drugs delivered to them, food that's refrigerated. Dealing with a community that lived in a food desert now goes back to that once again. But most importantly, the issue of structural racism that you're talking about, India.
Exactly. We have dubbed it food apartheid because it is a policy decision. Deserts are naturally occurring. And the fact that there is no food on the east side of Buffalo and there's not the availability of these basic services is a policy choice. There are people who actively chose to not provide services in this community. And for a long time, we've been told that this Tops on Jefferson, we are lucky to have it because no one else wants to come into the neighborhood because they're afraid of retail theft or many other reasons why we have been led to believe that Black folks don't deserve the same things that other communities do.
So you talk about segregation by design, that is a description of your neighborhood. Can you explain how the Kensington Expressway divides the African-American community?
Absolutely. You know, there again, a policy choice where folks needed to get in and out of the city of Buffalo very quickly. The Kensington Expressway was designed to move people from the airport, from the first ring suburbs into the city quickly. And as a matter of fact, there was an intentional choice to blast through very hard, multiple levels of rock to sink the expressway so that folks coming in and out didn't have to see the blight that resulted in the surrounding communities, right? So it's get in and out as quickly as possible. It's had devastating environmental impacts, health impacts. We know that folks who live around the Kensington Expressway have higher rates of asthma and heart disease and other very preventable illnesses. And again, as aggressively as policy was created to make the harm, we have to make sure that the equal and more energy is put into undoing that, right? And $1 billion has recently been allocated to cover a portion, but we also know that that's not a real solution, right? It should be filled in, it should be eliminated and restored to the beautiful parkway that it once was.
What do you want to say to President Biden tomorrow? What do you want to say to this country about this act of domestic terrorism that has taken place? This young white man who describes himself as a white supremacist, as a fascist, puts out this 180-page screed, much of it taken from the Christchurch massacre screed, that talks about the great replacement theory and more. He had actually come there a day before to the Tops to do reconnaissance. He wanted to kill many more people. He was picked up a year ago by state troopers because his school had called the state police. They were so concerned about him and so much reminding us of what happened with Dylann Roof, traveling hours to get to a site of African-Americans who he could kill. In that case, it was the church in South Carolina. In this case, it was Tops.
We are at yet another moment of national reckoning, right? This is not an isolated incident. This is more than half a century of oppression, of systemic racism. And now is the time to renew the call for reparations. I think we need bold, reparative action on the forefront of all of these conversations. Prayers and thoughts are not enough. We live in communities that have been redlined, people who have been intentionally left out of our economic system, people who have been preyed on, extracted from. And if we're going to begin to heal as a country and really beat back what is systemic racism that causes these extremist ideas and homegrown terrorists, our people have been terrorized for generations in this country. Our existence in this country comes from a place of terror. And if we're not having conversations about reparations, if we're not having conversations about actively undoing the harm that has been caused by redlining, by intentionally leaving Black people out of economic and social upward mobility, then it's a non-starter for people like me who do this work, who care for our communities. You know, we're tired. I'm tired. This dude was allowed to go into our grocery store and shoot up a bunch of grannies and aunties, right? And children, an 8-year-old girl hid in a freezer, afraid for her life. And, you know, I'm tired of prayers. I don't want that. We need resources. We need money. We need the accessibility and availability of our own things. We have our own grocery stores. And we need to be able to have the self-determination on autonomy to protect ourselves and our own community.
India Walton, we want to thank you for being with us, former Buffalo mayoral candidate, longtime community activist, now senior advisor for special projects for Working Families Party, and also works with Roots Action. Next up, we'll be joined by Professor Ibram X. Kendi. His new piece for The Atlantic headline, The Danger More Republicans Should Be Talking About, White Supremacist Ideology is Harmful to All, Especially the Naive and Defenseless Minds of Youth. Stay with us.
There are lies that entertain you. They use lies so they can blame you. Look in my eyes. Surprise, I can tell you're blue.
Because all 12 kings of all is to be found.
Not the Enemy by Nick Alexander. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're looking at the mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, Saturday, when an 18-year-old white supremacist wearing full-body armor, carrying an assault rifle, opened fire on a supermarket in a black neighborhood of Buffalo. We just went to Buffalo. Now we're joined by Ibram X. Kendi, the Andrew W. Mellon Professor in the Humanities at Boston University, founding director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research, contributing writer at The Atlantic, where his new piece published, well, it looks like it was published yesterday, but it was actually published last month before the attack in Buffalo, headlined, "The Danger More Republicans Should Be Talking About: White Supremacist Ideology is Harmful to All, Especially the Naive and Defenseless Minds of Youth." He's also the author of many books, including Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. Also author of How to Be an Anti-Racist and the children's book Anti-Racist Baby. He's got two forthcoming books out in June, How to Raise an Anti-Racist and the picture book Good Night Racism. I hope those books won't be banned the way a number of your books have been around the country, Professor Kendi. But as you watch this horror unfold this weekend, I think it's very critical to talk about taking the word fringe out of fringe theory, the great replacement theory, because how mainstream what is motivating quite explicitly this young self-identified white supremacist fascist who only wished he had killed more people.
Exactly. I mean, some of the leading politicians and media figures and intellectuals, particularly over the last 2 years, if not the last 10 years, have been asserting this idea that anti-racism, that critical race theory, that Latinx immigrants, that so-called black criminals, that Muslim terrorists, that people of color are harming or seeking to replace or even engage in a genocide against white people. That's the great replacement theory. That is a dominant talking point, particularly among members of the Republican Party. And so this is certainly not a fringe theory. It was a fringe theory on many levels a decade ago, but it's certainly not now.
So respond to what took place this weekend, how it's covered, the issue of it being a domestic terror attack, not a lone gunman, you know, who is suffering from mental illness. Last year, his school was so concerned about what he was saying, they called in the New York State Police, who had him taken for a mental evaluation, yet he could still lawfully buy in his hometown the weapon used in this attack.
For years now, law enforcement officials and FBI have been talking about and have been acknowledging, whether you're talking about the head of the Justice Department or the head of the FBI or even local officials, have been referring to white supremacist domestic terror as the leading terrorist threat of our time. And it's indisputable. And we also know that the people who are most likely to carry out these acts of domestic terror are younger white males. And so the fact that people that this nation still does not recognize that we have a serious problem on our hands, and these younger white males are engaging in all sorts of acts of terror against Jewish Americans, against black Americans, against Asian Americans, against women, against people from the LGBTQ plus community. And that, you know, I mean, that to me is part of the sort of horror that to me is part of the toll that I think is weighing on people, because even after all of these mass murders and shootings over the last few days, people still don't feel as if this nation is seeking to protect them, is seeking to keep them safe.
As we continue our coverage of the massacre in Buffalo, what led to it, I want to look at the role of Fox News in pushing the great replacement conspiracy theory in opposition to gun control, particularly through Fox's most popular host, Tucker Carlson. A New York Times investigation last month found he invoked the conspiracy that Democrats are trying to force demographic change through immigration in more than 400 episodes of his show on Fox News. I want to also bring in another guest to join Professor Kendi. Nikki McCann has spent years compiling evidence for the watchdog group Media Matters of how Tucker Carlson has used his show to launder white nationalist ideology. Nikki McCann Ramirez is going to join us in a second, but first, just a few examples she found of Tucker Carlson repeatedly defending the white supremacist great replacement conspiracy theory. This is Carlson lashing out last April at President Biden's immigration policy.
An unrelenting stream of immigration. But why? Well, Joe Biden just said it. To change the racial mix of the country. That's the reason, to reduce the political power of people whose ancestors lived here and dramatically increase the proportion of Americans newly arrived from the third world. And then Biden went further. He said that non-white DNA is the, quote, source of our strength. Imagine saying that. This is the language of eugenics. It's horrifying. But there's a reason Biden said it. In political terms, this policy is called the Great Replacement, the replacement of legacy Americans with more obedient people from faraway countries.
And that's Tucker Carlson on Fox News last April. This is another clip noted by Media Matters from last year as Carlson's fear-mongering about white replacement genocide and a race war.
The left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Let's just say it. That's true.
For more, in addition to Professor Kendi, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Nikki McCann Ramirez, Associate Research Director at Media Matters for America. Nikki, thanks so much for being with us. As we talk about what motivated this 18-year-old white supremacist, talk about the great replacement theory, where it came from, and what Tucker Carlson is doing with it, and how it's being weaponized by everyone from the New York Congress member, Elise Stefanik, to the senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, Congressman Perry, and more.
Well, yes, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. The Great Replacement conspiracy theory has existed for decades. It is a subset of a larger conspiracy known as the white replacement or white genocide conspiracy theory. And it really came into a renewed era of prominence in the last decade with a period of acceleration in the last 3 to 4 years. In 2012, a French writer published a book called Le Grand Replacement. And what it essentially argues is that there is a cabal comprised typically of elites, Jewish people, because this is fundamentally an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, and media figures who are using immigration, birth rates, and multiculturalism to eliminate or replace the white race. This theory baselessly makes these accusations of what are essentially natural or cyclical changes in demographics. And what it does is create a dynamic where believers view immigrants and non-white people as an existential threat, not only to themselves physically, but to their position in society. And importantly, this theory wants believers to act against their supposed replacement. So when people like Tucker Carlson present a ready-for-cable version of the theory, it makes more extreme versions of it more accessible to audiences who would have never encountered it or would have never really thought about it. And if people believe in portions of the theory, like the idea that immigrants are being, quote unquote, imported to replace them demographically, it becomes easier to tack on more extreme versions of the theory and fold them into their beliefs.
Can you talk about how Fox News has been covering this massacre?
Absolutely. So a notable thing that we've seen pretty much since the coverage broke is that Fox has been very hesitant to make any reference to the Great Replacement theory or talk about specifics about what was in the shooter's manifesto. And to be clear, the shooter's manifesto did not directly reference Tucker, but Fox News is aware that they have been pushing this theory, selling it toward their audience, and they do not want to make that connection themselves to explicitly connect that theory to their audience once again. I believe what we're seeing Fox News do right now is kind of fold back and fall back onto traditional reactions that they have to mass shootings, that this will be used in an attempt to promote more gun restrictions. Or as we saw yesterday, one of their hosts on a Sunday show said that this shooting will be exploited to unfairly censor conservatives. I think Fox News is very aware of the hand that they've had in bringing this conspiracy to mainstream audiences. An Associated Press poll recently found that 1 in 3 Americans now believe that immigration is being used as a form of electoral manipulation, electoral replacement. And they are very aware that they have a hand in this narrative. So they are being very cautious about how they cover this and are really trying to deflect the narrative onto other issues that don't necessarily implicate them.
Do we know where the 18-year-old shooter, alleged shooter, Peyton Gendron, learned about these theories? I mean, it's a vast screed that he's got, something like 180 pages, where he lived online, et cetera.
Yes. So the shooter did publish a more than 100-page manifesto. And I want to make a caveat here. As we already know, the manifesto was largely plagiarized from writings of other shooters, writings that he found online. So we should always take these self-published screeds with a bit of a grain of salt. What the shooter claims is that he was radicalized on 4chan and other online forums, that he didn't really have a lot of direct contact with cable news. But what extremism researchers know is that Tucker Carlson's rhetoric is very present on these forums. A lot of people on these forums view Tucker Carlson as an ally in presenting their messaging to a layman's audience. So it's not unlikely that this shooter encountered Tucker Carlson, his rhetoric, his statements about immigration, people of color. It wouldn't be unlikely that he encountered them online. And it's important to point out here, once again, that presenting a sort of stripped down version of this theory, which is what Tucker Carlson does. He doesn't explicitly make references to racial superiority or explicitly make this references to anti-Semitism when he talks about Great Replacement. But what he does do is give viewers context clues that allow them to make those connections themselves. He regularly attacks Jewish billionaire George Soros as an enemy of Western civilization who's attempting to destroy America. He uses very racialized language when discussing the theory. And what that does is make it easier for his audience to find these more extremist spaces, to make those connections, and directs them toward a place where when a shooting like this happens, and you have a third of the population that already believes that a large portion or a central tenet of this theory is true, it's a lot harder for people to disavow it or to say, that theory is incorrect, I shouldn't subscribe to it. They can say, oh, well, this was a quote-unquote lone wolf attack, or this man was crazy and acting on his own. But the underlying beliefs can still be considered true. And that is a very dangerous thing for the most watched cable news host to be doing.
I mean, you can't help think about what happened here, what happened at the church in South Carolina, what happened in El Paso in 2019. The shooter deliberately went to a place with a large Latino population, clientele, customers, the local Walmart. He also issued a screed railing against a Hispanic invasion and posted that online. This was in 2019. Professor Kendi, clearly the vast majority of domestic terror attacks in this country are being perpetrated by white, right-wing, white supremacist extremists. And yet what we have in this country is state after state banning teaching about racism, essentially, when they talk about critical race theory, a very loose definition of it. Can you respond to this? I mean, we're talking about absolute horrors taking place all over this country.
I think that that is the reason why this crisis of white supremacist domestic terror is likely to get worse, because studies have shown that anti-racist education, that anti-racist books serve in a protective fashion, particularly from white youth, when they are exposed to white supremacy, because through learning about the history, let's say, of white supremacy, they're better able to recognize it. So then when they're approached or they see a white supremacist meme, you know, online, or a white supremacist enters into their multiplayer video game, or they receive messages on 4chan, they're able to recognize it, you know, as not only white supremacist ideology, but also they're able to recognize it as wrong. But because we're in a time in which there's, even before this so-called attack on critical race theory, there was a very abysmal amount of anti-racist education in schools, and there were a very few teachers who felt they had the ability or even the courage to teach the truth about race, and that has only declined. And so there's even less of an ability to protect particularly white male teenagers, which then makes them even more vulnerable to white supremacist ideology at a moment in which they're trying to figure out why there's so much polarization. What is the existential threat? Is the existential problem racism, or is it anti-racism? Is it white supremacist ideology, or is it people of color? And clearly these white supremacists are making the case that it's people of color, that they're the source of their pain, which is something that many of these young white male supremacists are being indoctrinated on, groomed on, and thereby carrying out mass shootings. And this is only going to get worse if we don't get a handle on it.
So what does anti-racist education look like?
Well, anti-racist education, first and foremost, is teaching our children about the history of white supremacist ideology, the role that white supremacist ideology played in racial slavery, in settler colonialism, in Jim Crow. It's also teaching white children and children of color about all the different people of all races who challenged settler colonialism and slavery and Jim Crow and mass incarceration. It's teaching children that there are multiple cultures, just as there are multiple cultures, colors, and we should value them all equally. It's teaching children that the source of racial disparities and inequities in our community is not the inferiority of a particular racial group, but this history and presence of racist policies. It's teaching children, you know, our racial reality, so that they can see that though we look differently, though when we speak differently, we're all equals. But the cause of these inequities are indeed racism.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. There is so much more to talk about, and of course, we'll continue this discussion. Ibram X. Kendi has a piece in The Atlantic, which will link to the danger more Republicans should be talking about. White supremacist ideology is harmful to all, especially the naive and defenseless minds of youth. Professor of Humanities at Boston University, founding director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research, and Nikki McHenry Ramirez, Associate Research Director at Media Matters, joining us from Washington, D.C. We will stay in Washington as we talk about the abortion protests, the hundreds of protests that took place nationwide this weekend. We'll speak with Renee Bracey Sherman of We Testify.
We got to put down abortion. Civil rights of women, make diversity legal, make it finally understood through the civil rights of women. And if you don't like abortion, don't have an abortion, and teach your children. like they are your children. Compassion has many faces, many names. And if men can kill and be decorated instead of blame, then a woman called upon a mother can choose to refrain. And contrary to
Amendment by Annie DeFranco. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at the massive abortion rights protests that took place across the United States Saturday, kickstarting what reproductive justice advocates are calling a summer of rage. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in over 400 cities and towns, from Washington, D.C. to New York City, Chicago, Atlanta, Austin, Houston, Seattle, Phoenix, Los Angeles, as part of a coordinated day of action under the banner Bans Off Our Bodies. The uprising comes in response to the recent publication of a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion showing the court is poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. Monica Simpson, the executive director of Sister Song, spoke at the D.C. rally.
We need you to get in this fight with us. We need you in every action. We need you in every state, in every place, and everywhere to ensure that we have the reproductive justice that we deserve. I know it's a hard fight, y'all. I know we got the long haul to go, but if we stay connected, if we stay together, then I believe that we will win. Do y'all believe that we will win? I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will. That's what I'm talking about. Peace and blessings, everybody. Thank you.
This comes as frustration with President Biden and the Democratic Party is growing as the party controls the House and Senate, but has failed to put forward a plan to preserve federal abortion rights, even if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. Last week, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia joined with Senate Republicans blocking the efforts. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other top Democrats are continuing to support a conservative anti-abortion Democrat in Texas, Congressmember Henry Cuellar, despite his longstanding opposition to reproductive rights. Cuellar is the last anti-choice Democrat in the House and faces progressive challenger Jessica Cisneros in a tightly contested primary election runoff May 24th. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Renee Bracey Sherman, activist, founder, executive director of We Testify, which is dedicated to the leadership and representation of people who have abortions. She's written a number of pieces in Time magazine, Voting Won't Save Abortion Rights, and last year wrote a Rewire piece, The Fall of Roe Was Driven by Our Country's Original Sin, Anti-Blackness. Renee Bracey Sherman, welcome and explain.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here. Where do I begin? I mean, your last segment was talking about white replacement theory. And I have long argued that the anti-abortion movement is simply the political movement of white nationalists and white supremacists, because they have been engaged in white replacement theory since the beginning of abortion restrictions, which started in the 1860s because Black people got free, right? Slavery ended. And they were afraid that white women were not going to have enough children to be able to maintain the population, and that Black people would continue to have children as they were forced to do under chattel slavery, and take over and become a higher in population, political voting blocks, things like that. So abortion restrictions were really to push white people to have more babies, and restrict and, again, control the fertility of Black and brown people across this country. And every single time you see Black people getting free, Black liberation after the civil rights movement, after right now Black Lives Matter, right, you will also see a lot of anti-abortion restrictions because white people are afraid of the political power that Black people are able to get, and people of color everywhere, right? Immigrants, undocumented folks, like queer folks, all of us, they are afraid of us challenging the status quo and being able to decide if, when, and how to have our families. So all of this goes hand in hand. That is why when we talk about this, it can't simply be
oh, we'll just vote in more politicians, right? If we do not have politicians and legislative leaders that understand how complex all of this is and how we need a multi-pronged approach to protect our freedoms, our reproductive freedoms, we're never going to win. And we will always see restrictions on our families. It is all connected.
Renee, you're wearing a T-shirt that says, I had an abortion. Why is that so important to proclaim? It's really the foundation of your organization.
Yeah. Well, like many of the people watching right now, I had an abortion when I was 19. It was one of the best decisions I made in my life. I was in a relationship that was toxic and unsafe. And I simply did not want to be pregnant, and I did not want to parent at that time. So I knew that I could have an abortion. My family had talked to me about it years before, and so I did. But I felt the stigma and the shame, particularly as a biracial Black woman who'd had an abortion and didn't really see people talking about abortion access for us and the intersection of racism, anti-Blackness, and lack of abortion access, and how for Black folks, we're damned if we do, damned if we don't, right? The same people who shame us for having abortions are the same people who shame us if we are single Black parents. And so I felt a lot of that shame. And so I decided that I didn't want to feel it anymore, and I wanted to start sharing my story. And it was because I met other people who've had abortions. And then I shared my story so much that people in my family started sharing their abortion stories, including my mother, who later told me that she'd had an abortion before I was born. And so it really reminds us that everyone loves someone who's had an abortion, and abortion is a way in which we can grow our families and create our families. It's how we build our families. And it is why I am here, because my mother was able to decide if, when, and how to grow her family, and I was able to make that same decision. I think it's really critical for this moment for all of us who've had abortions to share our stories. You saw that at the rallies across the country. I'm sure there were a lot of people who were sharing their abortion stories for the first time, and some who were sharing it for the 20th, right? This is a moment for us to share our stories, change the conversation, and demand action now.
Renee, you've been very critical of the Democratic Party. The conservative Supreme Court is about to hand down a decision. If the draft is an indication, which we expect it is, the draft opinion, they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. But you're also critical of the Democrats. Why?
Yeah. You know, I've learned over the last couple of years, I guess the worst thing a progressive or radical can do is ask Democrats to do their jobs when they have power. I have been an abortion activist for well over a decade, and I feel like I've seen a lot of broken promises to people who are trying to get abortions, right? During the Obama years, when we saw all of the restrictions just come, you know, enacting across the states, we asked if there was action that could be taken, and there are several times in which the administration said that abortion access wasn't kind of the front issue. And in fact, policies that were racist and discriminatory, like the Hyde Amendment, which doesn't allow Medicaid to cover abortion care, was not repealed. There wasn't even like using a bully pulpit to try. And so we were asked to wait and wait and wait. And meanwhile, I still get all of the emails from all of the Democrats, because I am a Democrat, all those emails saying, you need to vote for us, you need to fundraise for us, because we're going to save Roe. And I'm just asking when, because it's been well over a decade of this, and I want to know, where's the action? Today marks the 481st day that President Biden has been in office, and he has only used the word abortion once. He has not given us a plan. He has not had an open meeting with people who are having abortions or providing abortions in this moment. In fact, he has spent the last 2 weeks since this leak meeting with police officers to give them more money. He has met with gun manufacturers. And so my question is, at what point are we, those of us who have had abortions, who are trying to have abortions right now and providing abortions, going to get that same attention from our pro-choice president? It is super important that everyone votes. Absolutely. And you should vote for politicians who are going to protect your bodily autonomy, whether it's abortion rights or trans rights. But also, when those elected officials are in office, it is not enough to vote for them. We need to ask them to do their jobs. Where is the plan? President Biden promised us a whole of government response, and we need to see it.
Renee Bracey Sherman, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of We Testify. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.